Hello and welcome to the Coastline Covenant podcast. I'm excited because it is Advent, and on the podcast during Advent, we talk about Christmas hymns. Michael and I sit down with sometimes a guest, sometimes just him and I, to talk about the inspiration, the theology, the story behind some of our favorite Christmas hymns. And this year is no different. We are talking about Away in a Manger today. And Away in a Manger, very interesting Christmas hymn. The authorship, it's a mystery. The melody, it's a mystery. But the message is not. It is a sweet song sung to children. Michael and I talk about it. We talk about the theology behind the song. We talk about maybe the heresy behind the song. We talk about the mystery behind the song. This is a really fun conversation, but we started all off talking about Eras Worship Night. For those of you who don't know, the Eras Worship Night was a night we had a couple weeks ago at Coastline where we just sang songs from throughout the history of the church. Michael and I talk a little bit about collaborating on that and how we think it went, and then we jump into Away in a Manger. So thank you for listening. We hope you are having a great Advent season so far. We will see you next week and every single week after that. Hello and welcome to a festive episode of the Coastline Covenant podcast. Festive for so many reasons. I'd say chief among them is we got a new podcasting setup. And by new, I mean like it's tangentially better than our old one. Not, I wouldn't even say better, just different. It's mobile.
It's portable.
It's portable. So normally people come into my office to record. I came into Michael's today. So let's just do it in your office.
It's a new day.
Because we're starting a new series, a new old series here on the podcast where we are discussing Christmas hymns. And no, the past 2 years I've said your favorite Christmas hymns. This year, Michael and I have found what only can be described as the bottom of the barrel.
The bottom of the barrel.
It could not be more grasping for straws here on the Coastline Covenant podcast this season. There are some actual songs that you're going to be like, oh, okay, like we'll do Silent Night in a couple weeks, First Noel, but there are, we're going to sandwich them, I think, with two hymns, two Christmas songs that are not necessarily seen as shining, bright, beautiful Christmas stars. Would you agree?
Well,
I agree.
I personally agree, though. Gallup.
I know. That's funny that you mentioned them.
Would disagree.
Well, before we actually talk about the hymn at hand, let's debrief something that happened to both of us a couple weeks ago. And that was the Eras night for worship. And I've been excited to talk to you about this because we've actually not talked since that night about this particular night. We texted a little bit back and forth afterwards. But Eras night, for those of you who don't know, this was an idea that someone had at some point about doing a worship night where we go through some eras of the church and we sing different songs that correspond to different eras. And we sang hymns, we sang Hillsong, we sang Chris Tomlin, we did some Vineyard songs. And so, Michael, I want to ask, in your best estimation of Eras Night, who thought of it? Who came up with it? And what kind of work did you put in specifically for the Eras Night? Now you're laughing. I don't know why.
I'm laughing because it's funny because you kind of said like, you know, someone came up with it.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is that behind the scenes in our office, there's been some, I mean, I wouldn't call it drama because that's too strong of a word, but I would call it, you know, there's been some suspicion around the office as to who it was that actually came up with this idea.
Yeah. A lot like our hymn that we're going to talk about today.
A lot like the, you know,
the
what?
Mystery
this
of
totally
it all.
Ties in, guys.
Yeah. So that was totally my plan.
Who was the author or the original idea maker of Eras?
The Eras Worship Night. The Eras tour is Taylor Swift.
You know, what people might think is that maybe it was me. That's what you might think, and you would be incorrect.
Wow.
Because I was not the person who had the original idea. Well, I've thought about the idea of kind of reaching back and doing a worship night with old songs, older songs before. It wasn't the Eras connection was not made by me. So what happened was Hunter came to me and said, we went to the Eras night of Taylor Swifting.
Just footnote, no one talks about anything like that. You would never go to a concert and be like, we went to the concert night of Jonas Brothering. Like that's, I don't know why you said that, but continue please.
Just came out that way.
I just wanted to footnote that in case someone heard it and said, is that something I should know what he meant by that? Because that
we
was...
went to the Eras concert here.
That's one way to say it. I would say actually probably the way to say it.
We went to that concert and when we were there, Hunter kind of turned to me and said like, hey, we could probably do this in the church. And then I was like, oh man, that's a crazy idea to think of, you know, how could we do something like this in worship? So that was that. But when we got back and we started telling the team about, hey, I've got this idea, I want to do this worship night, kind of came from Hunter, there was definitely some pushback about, hey, I think this was actually Nikki's idea.
Yeah, that to me is, I would not deny it, but I also don't remember that happening at all.
I think she incepted you.
Whoa.
What if that's what happened?
It's just a big ol' inception.
I don't know. All I know is that her idea was great too. And together, both of your brains, you know, created a good event.
And the night was so fun that who cares who came up with it? I mostly just wanted to ask as kind of a funny thing. But yeah, it was this idea that Nikki had gone to Midwinter, the Covenant conference in January, and they had done something similar to this and most likely mentioned it to the team. Me being me, I was probably on my phone when she did. And then after the Taylor Swift show, I came to Michael. I was like, we should do it. And then that came together. So it ended up being a night where we went through some church history via music. A normal Sunday morning, Michael, how long does it take for you to come up with a set list?
It actually varies, but I would say like on average, it takes me a good like 5 to 6 hours of sitting in prayer and, you know, kind of finagling the set list until I feel good about it.
Yeah. And so for Eras, how many hours did you put into this set list?
Oh my gosh. To be honest with you, I don't know how many hours. I think it would be, I'm pretty sure that it was over 40 hours of just focused attention on that one thing, not including my other job, the rest of my job. But that, yeah, I would guess there was at least 40 hours spent finagling the set list to try and get it to work.
What do you think took so much time?
A lot of it took a lot of time. So yeah, so I was telling some people like there isn't like a tool that you can use to like search for what worship songs were popular in the church in X year.
Yeah.
I know because I was around,
right.
You know, at a certain point I was around, after 1986. but that being said, there's no tool that you can just search online.
Right.
And the reason why is because, worship songs were not actually like popular in Christian culture. They weren't ever winning awards at the Gospel Music Association Awards, or, you know, they weren't on the top 100 most played songs, on Christian radio. They were not, up until maybe like, I don't know, this is a shot in the dark, like 2006 or seven, somewhere in there is when it started to gain some more traction. And so when you search like, hey, most popular song, you know, worship songs from 2003, you're going to come up with something that Michael W. Smith probably wrote, or Stephen Curtis Chapman, or Rebecca St. James.
And even then, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that Google search is purely subjective, because who is actually tracking how popular a song is? So depending on, you know, your algorithm and where you're at, it could be different. You know, we actually experienced this today when we were looking up Away in a Manger.
Right.
You're like, oh, you should listen to this version. And that didn't even come up in my first like 25 searches on Spotify.
Right.
Because we just searched different things. So your search for a top worship song is going to be different than mine. And so your job was then to figure out what matches your experience and probably the experience of most people who are going to come to this worship night, right?
Yes. So I'm going to try and keep this short. Basically, I created a list of 100 plus songs that were all popular, like big songs in the church from 1970 to 2015. And these weren't like the ones that you listen to and you're like, oh, that was a good song. These are the ones that you listen to and you're like, this is the song of the week.
Yeah.
Like,
the point was to bring you back to that moment.
Right.
Right.
These are big songs, from the church, 100 plus songs. Well, then, Rachel and Hunter and myself got together and we started kind of weeding through that list of 100. And we had a theme that didn't really get mentioned.
Not
that
at
night.
All. And not only did it not get mentioned, I don't think we even thought about it post that one meeting.
Yeah. The theme was unchanging God. So the majority of the songs were kind of leading us to the unchanging nature of God.
Right.
But that being said, that, you know, kind of weeded through songs, we came down to a list of, it was something like 32 songs. I think in the end, and they were all shortened versions. They were all medleys. And then the big work was really coming in and creating charts and creating transitions between the songs. So I you know, to make the whole night flow so that it felt like you're not going from one theme to another and it makes no sense.
You wanted it to not be so disjointed, because inherently this is going to be disjointed.
Yeah, like the end goal, which I think we actually hit. I mean, I've had a couple people mention this to me. The end goal was, hey, we want this to be fun, mm-hmm. and we want it to be nostalgic, and we want it to feel like a bit of a romp through,
that's funny.
Through worship history.
Yeah.
Right? At the same time, we wanted it to have some inherent spiritual nourishment, you know, right. for it to feel like, hey, there's like actual worship is happening while we are nostalgically trouncing through history.
Nostalgic trouncing was also an idea for the name, but we ended up with Eras. I've gotten universal positive feedback, and not like, Hunter, you did such a great job, but like, wow, how great of all the work that Michael did. And that's totally valid and true. And I think that people really enjoyed it because the line between kind of the hokiness of, oh, look how many songs we can string together, and oh, this is really meaningful, it's razor thin. And mm-hmm. for people to be able to come and catch the vision of, this is really supposed to be meaningful, it's not just to say, hey, look how many songs we can stack. Because there were even times we were going back and forth in the prep of like, we can just stack words. Like,
yeah.
this word leads to this word leads to this word. And we even did that once, Holy is the Lord. And yeah. with what is the song we used for Holy is the Lord?
Was it You Are Holy? God of Wonders.
God of Wonders. Yeah. I could not think of the name for the life of me. I've put all of these songs out of my head. We spent so much time with them. Yeah. But you put in so much work, and I think it really showed, because if you had put in a lot of work to just make it technically amazing or like the most intuitive flow, I think people would have been like, well, that was cool. But I think you nailed the spiritual nourishment element of it, and I think that's what people liked so much. So I had a great time being able to participate a little bit behind the scenes and playing the night of, and I really hope there gets to be another one.
I mean, I gotta say though, I did put in a lot of work, but both Rachel and Hunter were very instrumental in helping bring the whole thing together. So it was a team effort for sure. And JP was here yeah. all day on Friday trying to get everything fun. In order. So the whole team really put in a ton of effort to make it work.
Yeah, it was a really, really fun time. Prepping with you was really fun. We were on a Zoom call with Rachel, and Rachel said it was like watching a mirror, because Michael and I were just so locked in on so many different parts of the prep and the planning. And that was really fun. It's always fun when you get to just play guitar at work for a couple hours. And so that was a very exciting day.
That's my everyday, dude.
I know, but we didn't do what we said we were going to do, which is email the team of like, hey, Michael and Hunter are going to be really loud today, so don't come in if you have work to do. We didn't do that, but nobody complained.
Nobody said a word.
Yeah. We had to like call it off too. We're like, okay, it's been 3 hours. We need to stop.
We need to stop.
Take a break. Yeah. Yeah. So that was the Eras night, and that is fun. And so now let's talk about some Christmas hymns. Third year in a row, we are doing it. I'm excited. This was definitely a jump ball year for me in terms of doing this again. If we couldn't justify the songs that we chose, then I was like, let's just forget it. Right. So this could potentially be the last year unless we want to reset it next year or figure out a different way to talk through hymns. But right now we're looking at this as our final year. And normally with your final year of something, you choose the best. We are just going with what's necessary and what's available to us, which is funny and maybe offending some people, because we're going to do some hymns that maybe are people's favorites and they're going to love them so much.
Yep.
But before we jump into this specific hymn, Michael, I want to ask, what's on your Christmas list this year?
Oh, Hunter, I've been thinking so much about my children's Christmas list that I haven't had a moment to think about my own
Michael Claus
Christmas
Michael list. And Caitlin Claus.
Yeah, pretty much, honestly. Yeah, we've actually been like throwing away toys, and our kids have been so good about it.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's been surprisingly like, I mean, it's not been easy, but it's been more easy than we would think. Like, hey, we're going to throw this dollhouse away. No! Okay.
Is that because you want to make room for more other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're going to really Marie Kondo this thing.
Yes,
and
let's go.
Just try to go with, I think what I realized this year was my kids have a lot of Barbies. They have a lot of like little toys and cars and whatever. And I've realized that I think you really don't love things when you have a lot of things.
Wow. Oh, we could do a whole podcast on that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's beautiful. Do you ask Sequoia, like, does this bring you joy? And he's like, yes or no? I mean, if you're really going to Marie Kondo this thing, you got to really Marie Kondo this thing.
Well,
no, not a chance.
He doesn't know what joy is yet, but
wow. I mean, he does.
He exudes it.
I know he knows what joy isn't, like when at the Arizona night, he fell down the stairs on stage.
Oh, yeah.
And he just beefed it hard.
He knew that wasn't a joyous moment.
So you're throwing some stuff away for your kids and you know what they're getting and what they want, but you don't have anything on your list. Hunter, I mean, there must be some board game out there you don't have yet.
Oh, I mean, there's always a running list of board games that I would like. Yeah, there's actually a board game right now. I have a poster in my office called Food Chain Magnate.
I see that.
And they have a deluxe edition that's coming out.
Wow, the double version.
Yeah, exactly.
I only say that because it looks like an In-N-Out sign.
It's the theme is like fast food. Mm. That's the idea. But all that to say, that's on GameFound right now. I'm really excited about it. And that will probably be on my Christmas list.
Love it.
There you go.
Awesome. Well, I'm really going to hope that you get that gift.
Me too, Hunter.
Fingers crossed.
Probably won't come for a year. So. Ugh,
is it? It's like in beta right now?
Yeah, it's in like crowdfunding. So.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that there was such a long on-ramp for you to get Food Chain Magnate.
Well, when it's deluxe edition, you know.
Why don't they just give you like a set you can add to your original set? That seemed to speed up the process.
You're not wrong on that, but this one, the original set is an amazing game design with a really terrible presentation.
Okay.
Because it's a really small company that doesn't have a ton of funds to like put a ton of production into into the end result. So that's, they're just starting from scratch and keeping the design, but starting the design, the like visual design and all of the components from scratch.
And now they're maybe a bigger company and they're going to crush it.
Well, it's another company that's coming in to do the deluxe edition for them.
Nice.
So anyway, this is all stuff you guys don't care about.
Well, I was going to say, maybe this turns into our weekly check-in of like, how are we doing with Food Chain Magnate Deluxe? Are we getting, any closer to it actually getting in your hands? And that'll be fun to track it. And then maybe next Christmas, instead of doing hymns, we'll just play the game on the podcast.
Sounds good. I think people would just love to listen to us move pieces around.
I can't think of anything more exciting or stimulating than that. But you know what actually is more exciting is what I would call tumultuously mysterious origin story of our hymn for today, which is Away in a Manger.
Away in a Manger.
Michael, what is your history with this song?
My history is... It's a lullaby.
Yes.
So it's always been played for me as a child in that context.
Wow.
I probably heard it for the first time on like some Disney Christmas cassette tape.
I wonder if that's the same case for me, because when I pulled this one up, I don't really have a story with it. I'm not like, I know this one from my childhood or something. I mean, I didn't grow up in the church. I've talked about that a lot, but I don't remember ever hearing this song for the first time. It does feel like it's just kind of been embedded in my experience as a person, especially somebody who is aware and excited about Christmas. But you had mentioned right before we started talking about Era's Night that this is a popular song.
Well, yeah.
According to Gallup.
According to Gallup, this song...
Which Gallup is a polling organization. It's not a horse company, just so people
right.
know.
Right. And they're trustworthy polling organization. But they say that apparently it is the number two most recognizable Christmas song.
Second most popular English Christmas song.
Yeah.
Which is insane.
It's totally insane.
And number one was Mariah Carey. Is that what it said? I don't remember. I didn't look at actually what number one was. Maybe I should have done my...
Well, it's the most I think most popular Christmas hymn.
Oh, okay. What would you call number one? Let's look it up.
I think Joy to the World, hands down.
I think we said that last year as well.
I'm pretty sure...
Joy to the World. It could be O Holy Night, maybe. What do you think about that being my counterpoint?
I think that's a good counterpoint, but I would guess more around the lines of number three or four there.
Do you agree? Do you think it is the second most popular? Does that feel authentic to your experience?
What I would say, no, it's not. I would put Silent Night before that. I would put the first Noel before that. I mean,
which are two songs we're actually doing this season, so thank heavens
we are. Yeah. I mean, there's just tons, you know, that I would say are more like colloquially recognizable. Obviously within the church, I think we play songs like Hark the Herald Angels Sing, which the church would probably say, oh, that's such like a, you know, staple Christmas song, but I don't know if the rest of the world would feel as much that way.
Right.
But this one, Away in a Manger, feels like, because it's got that lullaby nature to it, I think it's one that it kind of lives in your subconscious, like you said. It's something you hear as a child. It's around you, and you might even be like, I don't know when I first heard this. So
it's just embedded in there. So let's listen to it, and then we'll come back and talk about some of the history. We've been teasing the mystery, and I'm very excited to talk about that. Maybe you and I can come up together with a solution, and then talk about some of the theological themes that come up in it, and some of the heresies that maybe come up in a song like this. So it's pretty interesting. And so we're going to play the Shane and Shane version of Away in a Manger. So listen to it, and then join us afterwards as we discuss this song. Heard it, the Shane and Shane version from 2018. They made it decidedly not a lullaby, made it more, like you said, usable. I appreciate that. I think that was the right call to not make it, especially if you're making a worship album, a Christmas worship album. You're not trying to have it be so authentic to the experience that you had the first time you heard it, because like you said, it wouldn't make it usable. So if you were going to be making a Christmas set list and you had to pick Away in a Manger, is this the version you would choose?
I think either this or the Phil Wickham version.
Yeah.
The thing with the Phil Wickham version, why we didn't put it on the podcast, was that he makes up some new lyrics for halfway through the second verse, and then all the way, and the third verse is all kind of a new version that he wrote. So this one is kind of the more traditional version that we sing here in America that we're generally used to.
Yeah, they go right through it. It's all of the lyrics. A lot of times with these hymns, as we've seen over the years, cut a verse, cut a whole host of verses because it doesn't make sense or it doesn't flow very well.
Yep.
They kept it all. I think it's because it's a shorter song. I mean, it's just not an incredibly long or complex song lyrically, musically. It just kind of like is what it is. You kind of go straight through with it. But we've been teasing this a lot, and normally now I'd go through the history. You know, this is who wrote it, this is when it was written, but that is a big old question mark. And the really funny thing about this song is that it is classically attributed to Martin Luther.
Yeah.
Which is funny. Did you see why that was the case?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. It's, well, first of all, like, there's a version there. So the song, we call it Away in a Manger, but the original manuscripts that can be found of this song in English label it as Luther's Cradle Song.
Yeah, Luther's Lullaby.
Luther's Cradle Hymn.
Mm-hmm.
And even say something to the degree of this song was written by Martin Luther for his son or for his children, sometimes it says, and is still sung by German mothers to their children.
Well, that part isn't untrue, because what I have found is that this is a hugely popular Lutheran song, and it actually, the first version of this song comes from a Lutheran book that is entitled, what is it called? Little Children's Book. It's a Lutheran children's hymnal. And so that's, yep, the first time you see it in 1885. But that's one of the reasons, actually, that people don't think that Martin Luther wrote it. Because if Martin Luther had written a hymn that was this popular, why 400 years after he died do you suddenly see it in English?
Right.
So that's another reason people don't see it. And another, I saw a guy, there's a website called hymnsandcarolsofchristmas.com. And the person who wrote it, I don't know who this person is or what they do with their life, but it is probably a 25-page webpage. Like, I was scrolling a billion times because they are so obsessed with the history of this song. They go through and talk about it in so much depth and detail. It is one of the most interesting, most fascinating things I've ever read. But all that to say, they say their take is that, look, Martin Luther, historically brash. He's a mean guy.
Yep.
He's a little bit out of the pocket in the way that he talks. How could he possibly have written a lullaby this sweet and gentle, even regardless of whether or not it was for children? And so they look at the language and they say, there's no way that Martin Luther, the notorious verbal bully, would have written a hymn like this.
Right.
Michael, let me ask you this question then. In songwriting, how often are you saying, I'm going to put my own unique Michael point of view in this song? I want people to be able to trace it back to how I normally talk. Or is there kind of a character that you have to assume as you write music?
Wow, that's a really good question. I don't know if I have the answer, like the ubiquitous answer. What I would say is that it's kind of both,
mm-hmm.
Especially when you're writing church music, because you want it to feel authentic and personal and heartfelt and meaningful. And if you're just writing, you know, Christian words on a page and hoping that it's going to feel meaningful, if it's not meaningful to you, it's probably not meaningful to someone else.
Yeah.
Right.
That's good.
So you want it to be personal and meaningful while at the same time, recognizing that if it's too personal, then it can feel like it's just for you,
mm-hmm.
and not for the congregation.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say it that way, because I think there's a lot of like music that's labeled as very CCM, like very Christian contemporary music, that's not necessarily congregationally based. It's,
yeah,
way more personal experience or a little bit more reflective,
mm-hmm.
in the spiritual formation vein that we wouldn't necessarily sing on a Sunday. And it's actually really funny when those songs make it in. And a song that I could think of is Nothing Else by Cody Carnes. That song, I think, is... we play it in church a lot, but it doesn't necessarily feel like a congregational song.
It feels very personal.
Very
that's for
personal.
Sure.
Yeah. And you have a lot of Christian artists who do that, who kind of go inward and say, this isn't for a Sunday morning worship service. This is for a devotional time, which is actually pretty sweet to think of. You think of all the Psalms, you know, there's not always Psalms of happiness and joy and ascent. There are deep, dark Psalms of anguish and pain and questioning. And that's not for the good seasons of life. Those are for those questioning seasons of life.
Yeah.
But all that to say, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility to say Martin Luther could write a lullaby. I just don't know if this was the lullaby he wrote.
I completely agree. I mean, it's interesting that that's what's being said, is it just doesn't seem like him to be so kind and sweet and gentle, which I think makes sense. But I also think like the dude was brilliant and could obviously come up with something good, you know? Yeah. So, I don't know. I'm that point alone is not strong enough to sway me,
no.
But I think the other historical arguments that come alongside that point might have swayed me.
Yeah, the other historical point being translated from German, this doesn't sound like Martin Luther, not in the sense of his like anger or his vicious tone of speaking. It just doesn't feel like something he had said. He's never really done anything like this before. And it came out so late, it became so popular so late that why would it be attributed to Martin Luther? And I think the reason that it is because it is so famously a Pennsylvanian German Lutheran Christmas hymn, Christmas Lullaby. Mm-hmm. And it was originally found in a Lutheran hymnal. I did do some research and found that Martin Luther wrote a ton of hymns, and I maybe sound ignorant for not knowing that, but he wrote a ton of hymns. None we really sing, I guess, in the evangelical covenant tradition, but I imagine as a Lutheran, you probably sing these hymns a lot. He has a song called Now Praise We Christ Holy One from 1524, which is actually a Christmas hymn in and of itself. But no, I've never heard any of his songs. I'm looking at them. Though who art three in unity, all praise to Jesus's hallowed name. Lord God, thy praise we sing. These are all the most popular Martin Luther hymns, none of which I've ever heard, which just goes to show you, even the English speaking Christian experience is so wide and large. Just because we haven't heard it doesn't mean it's not out there.
The one that I've always attributed to him, which is he wrote, is A Mighty Fortress Is Our God.
Did he write that one?
That is a Lutheran hymn. And so that's the one that I always remember when I think of him writing songs. That's the one that pops into my mind. But other than that, there's not a ton of others that pop into my mind immediately.
It's just interesting. I thought that was really fascinating that you have such a mysterious history of a hymn that gets its start from one of the most famous figures in all of Christianity, which is Martin Luther. And I think it maybe has to do with the fact that so many of like the non-canonical books of the Bible, some would say like heretical books of the Bible, like the Gospel of Thomas or the Gospel of Judas, these things that came out later, is just people's fan fiction about Jesus that they just tack on famous names to in hopes that it gets somehow popular. And so maybe that was the case with this hymn. Somebody wrote it and was like, this isn't going to have legs unless I give it to Martin Luther, and I'll take the anonymity so my hymn can become popular. Because even if you do research it, there's nobody who's really attributed with the lyrics of this hymn. The first time, like I said, it was seen as 1885 in a Lutheran hymnal called Little Children's Book. The melody is popular. The melody had been used before. And then it really gets attributed musically to a guy named William Kirkpatrick and James Ramsey Murray. James Ramsey Murray was from Massachusetts. He was an American guy. Kirkpatrick, came over from Ireland, and he was a very famous hymn author. He had written another one that we sing to this day. Do you know which one it is?
No, I don't.
Tis so sweet to trust in Jesus. Yeah. Oh, wow. So same guy who wrote the melody and the famous accompaniment, the one we use most today, William Kirkpatrick wrote Tis So Sweet to Trust in Jesus. So All that, the music history is very easy to find, but the authorship isn't. And another thing I found that was really funny is it was very popular in this book called Father Finn's Carol Book. I don't know if you saw this as well. Father Finn's Carol Book, which was a East Coast hymn book for children. And it's attributed to a guy named Samuel Mack. It says a guy named Samuel Mack wrote it. And then later on in history, years later, somebody pressed Father Finn and was like, who is Samuel Mack? Like, who wrote this? And he was like, I don't recall. I actually don't think he has anything to do with this, if Samuel Mack even exists in the first place. And then another editor went and talked to Father Finn and tried to figure out what it was. And Father Finn basically said this about Samuel Mack. He just knew about everything there. He just about knew everything there was to know about these old songs. That's all we really know about Samuel Mack. In the Library of Congress, in the history of hymnals, you don't find a Samuel Mack anywhere. So he could have been a pseudonym for something else. So the mystery is remaining to this day. Two guys in 2023 cannot solve the mystery. Does that add anything for you, Michael? Does that take anything away from you?
I think it definitely made me, like, as I was studying for it, I was like, maybe I like this song a little more. There's just so much to dive into.
Shrouded
and know
in mystery.
It's so mysterious.
Yeah.
It's so, as I was studying, one of the things that I thought was super interesting is, in his article, Not So Far Away in a Manger.
That's the one I read from hymnsandcarols.org or whatever.
Richard Hill?
Was it Richard Hill? I think that was from the same place I looked.
So basically, it says...
Doesn't it start with like a beguiled librarian looking for the history of the...
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, that's the same thing okay. I read. That's okay. So funny.
So he basically goes into 41.
Yeah.
Of the nearly 200
yes.
different musical settings for this song.
I said, this is one of the most interesting things I've ever read in my life.
So apparently this song has been like used and used and used over about 200 times.
Yeah.
These lyrics have been used for 200 different songs. And, you know, and it seems like it's actually really interesting. We've landed on two. There's two tunes that we've landed on. And this I thought was mind-blowing. So in Great Britain, Ireland, and Canada, they sing Away in the Manger to the tune of Cradle Song, which is by an American composer. This is William Kirkpatrick.
Kirkpatrick, yeah.
Okay. Cradle Song. We do not, though, here in America, sing it to that tune. We sing it to the tune by a guy named Mueller.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the Mueller version.
The Mueller version. That is the song. That's the tune that we actually sing it right. to here in America. That if you're an American, you would think of it this way. Now, first of all, the Mueller song version and the Cradle Song version, they're different, but they both end really similarly with musically. They kind of resolve the same way, and they're kind of floating around each other when it comes to how they musically land.
So it's harmonious in that sense, but they're not the same.
They're not the same.
If sisters, not twins.
Exactly. Exactly. And interestingly enough, when I listened to Cradle Song, I was like, I know this tune. It was weird. But it wasn't the tune that we traditionally put this song to. So I don't know if there's another song that I've heard set in this, or if I've just heard it sung that way, in other versions. But all this to say, the interesting thing about Mueller is that basically what happened was he was writing this song, and he was a big time Luther fan.
Big fan.
So what happens is when he goes to, he pens the song, and then he instead of writing his name at the top of the piece, he signs his name with initials. He just yep. initials his name there. Well, he did that because he didn't want to take full credit for the authorship of the song, because he was a big Luther fan and he wanted Luther to get the credit. So what happens
is... Do you think he thought that Martin Luther had written it and he was like just finishing it? Or did he just say, okay, I don't even want any credit. I want this all to go to Martin Luther.
Yeah, no, I think he thought, hey, Luther wrote this song.
Okay, so he was part of that ilk.
Part of that ilk. He probably was he most likely was a Lutheran. I don't know, but my guess is that he was probably a Lutheran and a big time Luther fan, which then meant he didn't want to take credit for what was Luther's. Well, then what ends up happening is the song ends up getting published a bunch
yeah.
with this tune, the tune that we know.
The Mueller version. Mueller's version.
Yes. That gets published over and over again. And it wasn't for multiple years, like 20 years down the line, until someone was like, what are these initials? And finally they realized, oh, Luther didn't come up with this tune. This is not his tune. This is some other guy's tune. And what now the song is just called Mueller.
Wow.
That's the name of the song.
There's no ambiguity anymore. It's Mueller.
It's just called Mueller.
Just Mueller. Very German.
And I'm pretty sure Mueller was an American. So, but all that to say, it's kind of weird. Like they sing it differently in Great Britain and Canada than they do here.
That's fascinating. I didn't catch that. I mean, I was just so geeked out about the fact we couldn't find the author that I saw a bunch of stuff about the Mueller stuff, and I just was like, oh, that's wild. I saw the initial thing. But I just think it's so wild that we have so many different stories for so many of these songs. I mean, we've done, what, 10 at this point, 8 or 9 or 10 at this point. It's like, they all have such unique histories. It's very rare that it's like, oh, Charles Wesley wrote this and it's exactly how it sounds. Like,
right.
They always have these funny stories. And it's just crazy how these songs that are so... the history is just so frenetic and crazy. Like, they're so popular, especially a song like this. It's a children's song. Like, people really care about what their kids consume, right? And like, yeah, you wouldn't be like, I wonder where this came from, therefore I'm going to sing it to my kid. But that's the case with this hymn. And that's funny that that's kind of the transition point here, because if we look at the lyrics, it does feel very lullaby-y, right? Away in a manger, no crib for a head. The little Lord Jesus laid down his sweet head. Okay, little lullaby-y. And then the second verse, you know, stars bright in the sky, look down where he lay, the little Lord Jesus asleep in the hay. A little less lullaby-y theological and just kind of poetic. And then the third verse, people actually cite it as heretical.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they call actually, it docetism.
Docetism, which is the heresy, really quick, that Jesus only appeared to be human. He wasn't actually human. And right. So it's really important for Christian theology that Jesus was fully God and fully man. Him being fully God is obviously important for reasons that we can get into another podcast. Fully man's important because we need, like the author of Hebrews says, a high priest who's able to sympathize us in all things, who can go and understand what it's like to be human in the fullest capacity of being human. Thus, if Jesus was only kind of human or appeared to be human and was just the illusion of humanity, he doesn't really know what it's like to be human, and it's not really a full incarnation. It would make something like the Christmas story just an interesting story about a God who pretended to be a baby, which I don't think any God would ever do. Jesus was fully God, fully man. We affirm that here on the Coastline Covenant podcast. And so when this third verse comes up, the cattle are lowing, the baby awakes, but the little Lord Jesus, no crying he makes. Someone look at the no crying and they say, well, the baby Jesus didn't cry because he didn't need to cry, because he wasn't actually a human baby who actually needs to cry. Therefore, heresy. Isn't that interesting?
I find it really interesting, and it kind of feels a little vindicating, to be honest with you. And here's why. Because there's actually quite a few songs that I sing where people just get in a theological uproar about what it is that we're singing. Rightfully so. We should get in a theological uproar about the things that we sing,
right,
we in prayer to the Lord.
We should be thoughtful about these things.
We should be thoughtful about these things. But here's an example. What a Beautiful Name. Okay. The whole entire, when you think about the entirety of the song, okay, you have no rival, you have no equal, yours is the name above all names,
right?
Right? Okay, it's all God focused, right? What a beautiful name it is, not my name, Jesus's mm-hmm. name, right? The whole song is all so God focused. And yet, verse 2, you didn't want heaven without us, so Jesus, you brought heaven down. Mm-hmm. That one line has gotten, did, I don't think it's still, but when that song was released, it got the Christian world in an uproar, in a stir, because they were saying, oh man, Jesus didn't bring heaven down because he didn't want heaven without me. That's a man-centered, man-focused gospel.
I hear that.
And I think, how interesting, because I do think that he was doing the will of the Father, which was what? To save humanity, mm-hmm. because humanity meant something to the Father. So we meant something to the Father. So it's so interesting, because when you take one line out of context, out of the context of the whole, it's like we can just get in a theological uproar
yeah.
and stir. But when you look at that line, I actually don't love the line, to be honest with you. No crying he makes. Why? Just because he's God, he doesn't cry. I don't love that line, but...
Well, he did. I mean, you have to affirm that he did it.
Oh, he was a human. And he did cry.
Right?
In fact, there's scriptural evidence that he cried, he wept when his friend Lazarus died. So...
Well, that would... I mean, you can tease out the heresy and say, well, he was just appearing to be sad. He was
right.
really sad.
Well, he also... Was he appearing to be asleep on the hay?
Well...
Was he, appearing to, you know... I don't know. He was doing all the things that a baby does, except he just doesn't cry.
Well, he was just pretending. It was just the illusion. And what's interesting about that is, like, to the point that you're making with A Beautiful Name, and even a point with this song, like, this is not the Bible,
right?
Like, this song, it's a weird thing to say, but this can be heretical.
Sure.
Like, it doesn't actually matter that it is or isn't. It just is, like, if you are comfortable singing something like this and you can understand it. And we've had this conversation before, you and I, and we maybe even had it on the podcast, of like picking things to say, picking songs to sing, even though you know there's like a line that's a little bit of a sticking point. If you can understand it and you can justify it, it doesn't really matter. But I think if it's going to lead people into error, heresy, or like just confusion, then maybe it's not worth it.
Sure.
I don't see this line doing that. I see it being like a little poetic thing about how peaceful Jesus was as a baby, which, I mean, you have 3 children. Babies at some point are peaceful. I mean, they don't always cry. I mean, I could be wrong about that.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's the thing, right? Like, Some babies, when they wake up, they cry. Some babies, when they wake up, they don't.
They don't, right?
I mean, it's, I don't think this is making a ubiquitous statement saying, you know, Jesus never cried.
This isn't,
I don't think that's what it's saying.
And it's also not saying all babies are like this. It's not like some sort of child rearing document.
It's not. So I don't know. I mean, I would say it's not a big enough sticking point for me to be like, I'm not going to sing the song. At the same time, I don't love it. I don't sit there and go, man, what a great line.
We did Hark the Herald Angels Sing, you know, whether it was last year or 2 years ago. And like, oh, it was 2 years ago. And man, oh man, like every single line of that song is so deep and rich. And it's like, that's why we love this song. This is a little bit different where you're looking for the meaning and you're looking for those things. And with a line that is so interesting, like no crying he makes, my critical assessment is the song doesn't earn such a weird line. The song is not deep and complex enough to earn such a weird line. To me, it's just like, why put that in there? But I will say inversely, my critical assessment, now here's my critical praise of the song. How often do you get a Christmas hymn that is a invitation to the individual singer? You have the fourth verse, be near me, Lord Jesus. I ask you to stay close by me forever and love me, I pray. I think that's a really special idea that in the Christmas season, it is so focused on getting things and receiving things and what am I going to get, whether it is good in like, oh, time with my family or time off or rest, or it's things. And for most of us, it's, we just want some things because it's Christmas time. But I like that this puts it on a spiritual focus of like, no, in this time, I can lose sight of what really matters. But if I pray for Jesus to be near me, and to be close to me, I will keep my eyes on what really matters in this season. And so in that sense, I really like it. I also really like thinking of it as a lullaby. You sing this to a kid and they ask about this part of the verse and you can use it as a teaching moment. So in that sense, yes, I get it. I think melodically, I guess I never even clocked when you started saying it was a lullaby, that it is a lullaby. And I think that's why it's boring. Like it literally lulls me to sleep. And I think the Shane and Shane version does a good job of going past that.
Yeah.
But all that to say, like, Away in a Manger, to me, if I were to make a top 10 Christmas songs list, I don't know if this would make my top 10. I don't think it's a bad song by any means, but I think that this is an interesting one where the history is a lot more compelling than the actual song.
I agree with you. That's really funny. Well, and I don't know, again, it's weird, right? Because Gallup says that this should be like number 2
right,
most recognized Christmas hymn, which I mean, maybe. I trust Gallup, but it's just, it's not for me, I don't like it all that much.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. If I came to you and I said, hey, I have a lullaby song that's kind of boring and maybe heretical to some people, will you sing it?
I think if you started with that, probably not.
Right. But this is it.
I think this one has, there is a traditional value to this song.
Yeah.
We've been singing this song in the church for at least 100 years.
More. If you're Lutheran.
And so there's something about it that harkens back to Christmases of old and
German countryside.
Me in
a cradle with my dad, Martin Luther, singing to me. Yeah. My dad, Martin Luther, after he milked a cow and taped his 95 theses or whatever, he just sings this beautiful song. He turns off his anger for 5 minutes to sing about the heretical illusion of a baby Jesus.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. So Michael, let's do the final ranking here. What is this for you? Do you like this song? Do you not like this song? Where does this fit in the Michael Barker Christmas songbook?
Yeah. I mean, this is, when you said bottom of the barrel, it's not quite the bottom of the barrel because, right, you know, Mary Did You Know for sure is,
which we can on the bottom of the barrel. Reveal we are not doing that song this year. Yeah. I think that's like the last one we'll ever do. That might be the last episode of the podcast ever.
Yeah.
The Mary Did You Know episode. It's you, me, Andrew, Mary Beth, and Sean in a gauntlet style podcast episode where we talk about that song.
Yep. But I mean, it's not up there.
Yeah, it's not up there.
I do think that Shane and Shane version, as I was listening to it, was like, oh, this is actually usable.
It totally works.
I could see myself playing this one.
Yeah, it totally works for me in that sense.
And I could see myself singing it to my son, you know, like, hey, here it is. It's Christmas night, Christmas Eve, whatever. And I'm going to sing you this song, you know, while I rock him to bed. I could see using it that way. I don't love it as like a... let's sing it as the church song, unless it just fits the sermon perfectly or something.
If Sean preaches on Christmas Eve, or Garrick preaches on Christmas Eve, like a manger sermon, or if he's like, we're going to go through some heresies, you're like, all right.
We're going to sing some heresies.
We're
here we go.
Sing some heresies. Here, there we go. Well, Michael, thank you so much for not only going through this song with me, but giving me a little bit of a history lesson. I really loved that. When we were talking about, you know, a little behind the scenes, I had gotten my wires crossed to what song we were doing today. I thought it was a different song. And so I came to Michael, I said, oh, I just checked the document. It's actually this other song. And Michael was like, okay, I've researched the one that it actually is, which is Away in a Manger. And I'm not going to say anything about it. I want you to do some research. And I was off to the races at that point. I had so much fun researching it and finding out more about this song. And so I'm glad that we were able to learn something. I hope you learned something listening along. And man, if you are enjoying the Christmas season so far, go ahead and just jump on the Coastline Covenant Christmas post that we post about this. Jump on the Coastline Covenant Instagram, the post about this song, and just tell us if you like it. Honestly, I'm really trying to get a sense of if people like this song, if people are enjoying this song this Christmas season, because I have no idea.
Yeah. I'm wondering the same thing. I mean, I already said I don't like it, but at the same time, I don't hate it.
Are you afraid we're going to make some enemies?
I don't know. I just don't know. Wow. You know, I feel like with all these Christmas songs, after we, you know, give our opinions on them every year, I feel like I get a mixed bag.
Yeah. People,
you know,
come after us. It's like we're pseudo heretical, like the author of this song. You know, we'll have to ask Rochelle if this is a good children's lullaby. We'll get her on about another song. So anyway, Michael, thank you so much. Excited to be doing this again another year, the last year we're doing this. It's always fun to hang out and talk music with you and talk Christmas hymns. Hey, Merry Christmas to you and to your family. And when Sequoia wakes up and he doesn't cry this morning, just know that he's not an illusion of a baby. He's just a peaceful baby. Thanks for listening. And we will see you next Christmas hymn and every Christmas hymn after that.